Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of naturenow@kptz.org.
Hello, this is Debron Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the third week of June, wishing you all a very happy solstice. This week, we are very pleased to present part two of our field trip looking for bird nests in our neighborhood, with our guest Dr. Jeff Hammerson serving as our guide, and our friend Meg Amos along as recorder and field assistant, a show which was recorded last month.
We are continuing now on our field trip. We didn't get very far last time. We didn't get out in the field at all. We were recording background information on the porch. So we are finally out in the field, and we've stopped by the little nest snag that I keep talking about, this little willow. And I guess it's not technically a snag in that the top is gone, but it's still got some live bits off the side. And where the nest hole is towards the top, and it's this little hole. And like I said, it's had two sets of downy woodpeckers, and last year it had nuthatches nesting in it. And we know that the downy nests were successful because the young were so loud, but we were never able to determine whether there were live nuthatches come out of that hole or not. But
so that's a pretty small tree.
It's really small.
So where the nest is, the diameter looks like it's maybe 4 or 5 inches?
Yeah.
So one of the reasons why downy woodpeckers and red-breasted nuthatches are kind of more common than some of the other cavity nesting trees, because they're actually more smaller snags available than bigger ones. It just, especially these willows that live only a few decades and then they start deteriorating and they have softwood to begin with, and so these small willows around here that are kind of along the roadsides or the edges of little gaps that were developed here when the forest was younger and are dying now are just wonderful places for these small cavity nesters.
Well, and it really emphasized to me the importance of smaller snags. And I used to not appreciate willow trees, but I have come to really appreciate them. They're often filled with insects, and so they're great for feeding, and they're also great for nesting habitat.
Yeah, I'm totally with you on that. Most people look, oh, you know, it's a kind of a junk tree when you're next to this big majestic red cedar or Douglas fir, but wow, you know, the productivity they have for bird nesting is really, really high.
Yes.
So they're valuable.
Yes, indeed. And while we're standing here looking into that cavity, we're getting a dark-eyed junco ticking at us, because I just discovered it a couple of days ago. There is a nest in this clump of iris and grass that's at the base of my little garden spot here. It's ticking. I don't think you can hear it ticking, but it's making its little distressed ticking sound. And when we move out of here, it'll probably...
Let's move back a little bit,
yeah,
and see if it comes in,
yep,
and reveals where that nest might be exactly.
And they would be nesting right on the ground or in those grasses. I've got some little... My friend Fred Sharp gave me some little prairie... little mini prairies in pots, and it might be that they're nesting in those grasses. And that's how I initially found them, is by watering those little pots, and the juncos flew out of there yesterday. So all species are really cagey while they're sitting on a nest, and I bet you that they are sitting on eggs right now.
Yeah, and this is a good kind of example of what's a common pattern for nesting birds. It's not universal, but there are a number of species that follow it, and that is that the females make the nest on their own. So for juncos, the female makes the nest all by herself, and yet she has a mate, and he's involved in feeding the young after they hatch. But when it comes to actually building the nest, which is a little bowl or a cup of fine grasses, it's all the female. That applies, let's say, to another ground nester around here, spotted towhees, same thing. And there are lots of examples of that. And then there are other examples where both the male and female are involved.
So would this be the female that's clicking at us? It could be either the male or the female.
That looked like the male based on how black his head was.
So the male will protect the space but just not sit and incubate the eggs.
Right, he doesn't incubate either. Uh-huh. He's kind of waiting around for those eggs to hatch. And coming in, drop to the ground. Okay, now that's the same bird that was here before, really dark cap, and it's moved into the, it dropped to the ground and then moved over the ground among the bases of those plants and has disappeared from view. So probably, here comes another one.
No, that one just flew out.
Oh, it did? Mm-hmm. That's okay.
It's got some food.
It looks like a little worm type of.
It does.
We may have some hatchlings in there.
Or does the male ever feed the female on the nest?
That does happen. For example, nuthatches, when in that case, for example, I'm not sure about, I haven't seen that personally in juncos, but for nuthatches, the male will bring food to the female as she's incubating. And that's true of some birds, but not all.
Well, with the owls, it's classic that the male come feed the females on the nest, but I have never seen that with passerines before.
I'm not sure that that's true of juncos. We'll have to check on that.
Like so many things, by sitting here and watching, we learn a lot.
Right, so any bird that's carrying food like that is 99% of the time going to take that to a nestling. So it's not like, I'm not hungry right now, I'll eat this later. It's their behavior when they're going to feed a nestling. So the fact that it went into that site where you have seen them come in and out of makes me think we've got some little hatchlings in there.
Well, we'll have to keep our eyes on that. So we have just walked down just a few feet down the road, and we have encountered another willow snag. And this one has a series of holes in it, and it was nested in by red-breasted nuthatches, and you are the one that first saw them, right, Jeff?
Yeah, we were looking at your downy woodpecker nest just over there, and I was leaving on my bike, I think, and I went by this tree, and here comes the red-breasted nuthatch darting into that hole. So I slammed on my brakes and called you over. And what was really interesting and actually typical of red-breasted nuthatch is that not only they were going out of this tiny little hole, I mean, it looks almost impossibly small. There are a couple probably downy woodpecker holes above it that look gigantic in comparison. But the outside of that tree around the nest hole was smeared with pitch, like probably from Douglas fir, the resin that oozes out of the wounds of trees. And this is typical of red-breasted nuthatch. And they also do that on the inside to some degree as well. And both the male and female will bring in little globs of pitch and put it all around the nest hole. And that's pretty unique for birds. The only one I know around here that does that is the red-breasted nuthatch.
And that is such a smart strategy. I mean, it prevents predators from getting in there, right?
Yeah, it might prevent, let's say, a chipmunk, which they'll eat bird eggs, or other types of predators, even pests like certain kinds of insects that might affect the nestlings inside would be hung up by that. Also keeps sometimes other birds that might want to take over the nest. This is a pretty small one, so it would have to be something like the size of a chickadee or something like that in order to try to use that. But chickadees don't like all that pitch around it. You know, it's not anything they're interested in, and so it could keep a competitor for that nest site out of it as well.
Well, and the way that the nuthatches keep from getting pitched themselves is that they just fly in directly, right? They don't perch at the edge or anything. They just dive into the nest.
It happens very quickly. Yeah. They don't like hang out on the outside. But I photographed, actually at this nest, when it was active. This one isn't active right now. There's no pitch at all around the opening. But when it was active, I took a lot of pictures, and I've also seen in other nest sites for these nuthatches. Sometimes you'll see on the breast, the upper breast of the nuthatches, a little patch of missing feathers that I think they get caught up in that resin at the lip. Even though they get in there without contacting it, most, you know, for the most part, they don't get, like, they don't just land on the pitch. But sometimes their upper breast hits that, I think. And I've seen in some of my pictures this bare spot or, you know, a little indentation in the feathering there as if something had been pulled out.
Oh, that's funny. Jeff is pointing out that we're hearing warbling vireos. And Meg was asking what kind of nest they build, and he said he often sees them in this patch of alders. And Jeff, what were you saying, that they're a little, like a little hammock that they form up in?
Well, it's like a basket that hangs between in the fork at the end of a branch. So the branch will extend outward at the end of the branch, and it'll have a fork in it, and the nest will be suspended from that fork. And sometimes it's high, sometimes it's low. Vireos can be, sometimes you can actually look into the nest, they're that low. Warbling vireos, it could be at multiple heights, but they really love deciduous trees. So around in this neighborhood, it's mostly the red alders. If you're along a stream, it might be cottonwoods or something like that along rivers. Could be aspens. Wherever there's that kind of deciduous component, that's where they go. Here it's mixed, but it's a pretty good stand of red alders, so they're attracted to it.
We'll have to keep our ears out as the season unfolds. So we are now here, we're looking at the snag that was used by barred owls last year and the year before, and I'm looking at it now, and it looks like it's ready to fall down. I mean, it looks really, you can see through it in places. And it started as a raccoon nest, right, Jeff?
Yeah, I think it might have been 3 years ago. There was a family of raccoons that grew up in that same snag. And then the following year, the barred owls took it over and raised three youngsters there. And at this time of year, they were climbing out and standing in the openings and sometimes actually getting up to the top of that snag by mid-May. And I stood here with my camera on a tripod.
He has some really lovely photos.
I just, you know, just waited around because the barred owls feed their young day or night. Just, you know, they're big and hungry, and there were three of them, so they had a lot of feedings to do. Oh, there's a brown creeper going up the snag on the, just to the left.
Yep.
So we were talking about brown creepers earlier, and maybe the nest. There is some loose bark up there. We'll have to keep an eye on that to see if they're possibly nesting here. That one's working its way up a Douglas fir trunk. They always go up, then fly down to the next tree and go up that one. And there's a Pacific tree frog calling in the pond nearby. Let's see, back to the story. So it was fun to see what they brought to the youngsters, the barred owls, that is. And so I saw a couple instances of creeping voles that they brought and gave to the babies. A couple times they brought shrews. And one time they brought a black rat. which was big and had been torn apart before it was offered to the youngsters.
And Jeff has the most outrageous photo of the tail hanging out one side of the bill and the claw sticking out the other side. Perfect Halloween shot.
Yeah, a lot of people are kind of creeped out by that picture. And then once I saw the adult owl bring in a Pacific tree frog, which was just calling in the background there, coincidentally, but fed that to the baby and it just swallowed it right down. And then there are mallards that nest in the pond adjacent to the snag, and the barred owls made several passes. And while I was watching, they didn't catch one, but I think they did catch some that Rick saw and fed those to the nestlings as well.
We are now at our other neighbor's site, and there is normally water here, but it is now dry. And last year, they had mallards, several pairs of mallards nesting here, and at one point, they had 8 pairs of wood ducks, some of whom nested. I was just so blown away. There are some nest boxes, one of which I gave them years ago, and the wood ducks usually use a big tree, a cavity in a big tree, but they readily take to nest boxes, and they use the nest boxes. And we're here looking to see if we can see any of the mallards. Do you see any activity, Jeff?
Pretty quiet right now.
The pond here normally does have water, and for this early in the year, for it to be dry is really unusual, but they have had an infestation of reed canary grass, which we're going to try to help them get rid of. It's a noxious weed.
Yeah, this would be a time when you would expect to have a lot of amphibian activity in here as well. We know that this depression, when it has water in it, is full of tree frogs and newts and northwestern salamanders and probably other things. But it's been pretty quiet so far this year. I'm not sure. I wasn't here for the winter, so I'm not sure if it was a dry winter here or...
Well, it wasn't terribly dry. It would be interesting. They keep a rain gauge, so they would be able to assess how much water. But I don't think that it was abnormally dry for the winter. I think it's the vegetation change that's caused it to be so dry right now. So we are here at our last stop. We moved out of our neighborhood because Jeff had a lead on a bush tit nest, and he's taken us to one of our native wetlands in town. And you're going to hear a lot of red-winged blackbirds calling. And we are watching the bush tit nest right now. And it is a gorgeous thing. Jeff, do you want to describe it to us?
So like it's a sack, almost like a sock-like sack, almost a foot long, not quite, with an opening near the top. So it's hollow inside, and that's where the eggs are laid and where the incubation process takes place. And it's in a small dead tree, so there's no leaves around it. It's getting the afternoon sun. And
but it's completely camouflaged. I mean, it looks like just a heap of lichen. You would never notice it unless you knew where to look.
Even though it's not secluded by leaves, it blends right in, and you could easily walk right by it and not notice it, which is the whole idea, I think. The construction process makes use of not only vegetation, mosses, very fine leafy material, but spider webs are a very big part of it. The silk used in spider webs is gathered by both the male and female, and they use that to hold things together. And it also gives the nest some elasticity, flexibility. So when the young are developing, and they have an average of 6 nestlings, sometimes more than that, but average of 6. So it gets a little crowded in there, although it's a tiny bird, but the walls of the nest need to be able to kind of flex a little bit and accommodate the young as they're growing.
Well, like Hummingbird nests also, right? They have quite a large component of spider web, but not quite as elastic as this would be, but still enough stretch to accommodate from the teeny raisin-sized eggs to the young.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So those growing hummingbirds are tiny to begin with, but then they're pushing out on that edge of the nest when they're growing. So in this case, we mentioned, I think, earlier that juncos, for example, just the female makes the nest. In this case, both the male and female are involved in making this. And it's a long process. So a bird nest, a songbird nest, might only take on average 4 or 5 days, a week maybe slightly more than a week to make for most of the birds around here. But in this case, it might take them several weeks, and they might work on it for a long time before it's finished. And what they end up with, though, is an exquisite sack that serves the need to protect the young. You'll hardly see any pictures of bush tit eggs in nature, because you can't really ever get a glimpse of them, because there's a tiny little opening and they're sitting down there in the bottom. So there's no way of examining the nest without actually harming it.
We were talking earlier about how interesting it is that some birds have 6 or 8 or more young, and something like a band-tailed pigeon just has 1 young per year, right? Yeah, I mean, they're just way different. And not only are there multiple young produced per nest, but some birds produce multiple nests per year.
Yeah, American robin is a great example of that locally. They'll nest early, produce a group of youngsters, and they're off on their own, and then they'll start another nest. And they might differ in perhaps the first nest, but have 4 youngsters in it, and then the second one, 3 would be a common pattern for American robin. Song sparrows, same kind of thing, where they'll have multiple nests each year. Bush tits, no, pretty much it's one, around here anyway, it's one brood per year for each pair. But that's not to say that, look, for example, if a nest were destroyed, so most songbirds, if the nest is destroyed, they will re-nest, even if they normally would only raise one brood a year. But if there's enough time, it's early in the season, they can try again. But if they're successful their first time, as we said, like song sparrow, American robin will actually go ahead and produce another set of eggs and could successfully raise those youngsters, whereas other species would just do one nesting, and if it's successful, they're done.
And some birds, it's perfectly normal for them to skip a year. They won't reproduce in a year. I mean, a long-lived species like an eagle or an owl doesn't necessarily produce young every year, right?
Right, yeah. And even some smaller birds, it depends on the condition of the female and the food supply. So if the food supply is bad, then they could forego nesting.
So we turned off the recorder briefly because we saw a bird flitting off, and we were wondering if it was the bush tit, but we have not seen the bush tits yet. But while the recorder was off, we were talking about disturbance to nest sites, and we've tried to be really respectful of this site, but Jeff was reminding us that the most sensitive time is before they've actually laid their eggs, right, Jeff?
Right, during the nest construction process is when they're most sensitive to disturbance. So they're kind of still evaluating the site, as it were, as they're building and making sure it's going to be a good site. And if they're building and things seem okay, no disturbances, and everything seems non-threatening, then they may go ahead and lay their eggs. And once they do lay their eggs, then they're much, much more tightly bound to that nest site. They've invested a lot at that point. Or if there are nestlings in the nest, and once they get to those stages, then the birds aren't going to just abandon the nest if you walk by, or just unintentionally disturb a nest. Sometimes you don't even know it's there. and let's say there's a junco nesting in the grass and you walk by and she flies off and you look down and there are eggs in there and or nestlings in there, she's going to come back. The adults are going to come back and keep working on that. But if she was just, for example, in the process of building the nest, then a disturbance that might seem a little too threatening might cause the female to, or the pair to abandon that site and go elsewhere. So it's important not to disturb nesting birds at any event, but especially during the nest building process.
And it's especially important for people to keep their dogs and their cats indoors during this delicate nesting period.
So as we were standing here getting ready to leave and depart from the bush tit nest, a bush tit came up, landed in the dead tree that the nest is in, and then entered the nest cavity through the nest sac from the opening at the top. And it was the male who went in. We can tell the difference because the males have dark eyes and the females have pale eyes. It's possible that she is in there as well, because at times both the male and female will incubate simultaneously, which is kind of unusual, but it's an unusual bird overall.
There was no food. You didn't see any food brought in, so it's probably just incubating now, not feeding a mate or young ones.
Right, it was not carrying food. We got a good look at it through the binoculars, and it just perched a foot away and waited just a moment and then went right in and disappeared, and it's still in there. It's been a few minutes now.
So thank you so much, Jeff, for being our guide, and to Meg Amos for being our field recorder, to Nora Petrich for being our sound editor, and to all of you for listening once again. You can hear part one of our bird nest field trip as a podcast on kptz.org. And closing music this week is The Nest by Jimmy Spears. As always, wishing you happy trails.
I am ready for flight, oh my wings are so round.